Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahula Stepa Book Club. This week I'm joined by Adrian Childs, who's talking about his book, The Good Drinker. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, mate. Thanks for that introduction. I was on ITV London last week, and despite hours of briefing calls and exchanges of information, they went, Adrian Childs is here to talk about his book, The Big Drinker.
I've got the book right in front of me. It would be terrible to misread it. But yeah, The Big Drinker, that could be the follow-up.
That's the prequel, really.
Prequel, I suppose, yeah. If things go wrong, you could drift back.
Yeah.
Well, look, we talked a little bit about this, I think, when you were on the Rahulastra main podcast a few years ago. I think this did come up, the whole drinking. And this is a sort of fascinating book about your own journey through the decades with alcohol. Do you want to tell us where the impetus for this came from and why you wanted to write this book?
Well, I made a film, a documentary for the BBC called Drinkers Like Me, which arose out of this feeling I had that, you know, I never considered myself a problem drinker, but I was drinking more and more and more. And because so many of us have this notion of something called an alcoholic, which is, by the way, in the medical community, is not an expression used anymore. It's sort of way out of date. Yeah. But it's quite sort of hardwired into us, this idea of an alcoholic, and the image of whom is, you know, the caricature of whom is somebody who, you know, drinks wine in the morning, wakes up in shop doorways, sleeps on park benches, you know, always falling over and banging their head, all that kind of thing. Because if we're not that, then we think we're okay. And I just thought, well, I can't be okay. I'm drinking that much. And then I realized just how much I was drinking.
Yeah.
And I also realized it had slightly started knackering my liver. Only through making the program did I realize this. And then I resolved to drink less when I kind of pulled it off. So that's what I wanted to write about.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting journey in the sense that most people would go, I'm drinking too much, I'm going to quit entirely, or I'm just going to ignore it and carry on. And this book is about something that I find very difficult, doing anything in moderation, but the idea of sort of trying to get at least closer to, if not on, your recommended units per week, yeah. I suppose. Yeah.
I think because there is this, hardwired sort of Alcoholics Anonymous type attitude, although, you know, I'm very careful only to praise AA. I think they do brilliant work. But because of this idea of the alcoholic, inverted commas, accompanying that is this idea that the only real way of dealing with excessive alcohol consumption is to stop completely. And I think a lot of people who do drink too much are frightened of seeking help because they fear that they're going to be told they have to stop drinking completely, that that's the only way. And I think they fall between the gaps, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, I just wanted to get to them. And also, the vast majority of people who end up getting ill with alcohol, who end up getting liver disease or whatever, they are drinkers like me, or drinkers like I was, you know, drinking a lot, but not looking like the extreme drinkers.
Sure.
And so I think it's just important, you know, to get to them, to realize, you know, there's more of us because there is more of us drinking. So most people who present in hospital with liver disease are in my category, as was.
Yeah. Well, it resonated a lot with me. I think, you know, we're from the same generation, basically. You're a couple of years older than me, but the drinking culture, right? You know, I've been drinking. I've stopped for a couple of years now, so I've actually knocked it on the head, but not. I just stopped for a bit and it's carried on. I haven't really, it wasn't really, I've got to stop or anything. But when I started drinking probably at 14 and was easily, I think I was drinking every night at 14, but we certainly were out a lot. The whole culture of friendship was drinking. And then throughout both university and then my job, which is also a job like yours that involves a lot of time in pubs and going out with your mates, we were, you know, we're absolutely caning it through those times. So your story really resonates with me. You estimate that you've drunk 3 miles worth of drinks.
I mean, that was on the back of the envelope calculation. By the way, I would have been drinking every day when I was 14 if I got hold of the bloody stuff, but because I wasn't shaving, I couldn't get into pubs or anything, or I couldn't get served in pubs. So, I mean, that was about the only thing that limited me. But yes, I worked out roughly, if you laid all my drinks out, I've drunk in 40 years since I was 15, it'd be about 3 miles long, which is a lot of poison to put through your system. And that's bad enough. But I could forgive myself if I'd really enjoyed, wanted, or needed all of those drinks. But, I mean, more than half of them, probably two-thirds, I didn't particularly want, need, or enjoy consideration. I was just drinking for the sake of drinking. I was bored, drinking because I had half a bottle of wine left, drinking because I couldn't think of anything else to do, drinking because the pub was open for another hour, you know, drinking because it's what I'd always done with a particular friend, and just drinking, well, I'm here, I've got nothing else to do, I might as well have another one, and so on and so on. And it is mindless drinking. It's just, it's mad, you know, just all I've really done to stop, essentially, there's more to it than this, is just, I've stripped out the drinks I don't really want, need, or enjoy, and just focus on the ones I do want, need, or enjoy, and I enjoy them all the more.
Yeah. Well, you know, I completely got that. I remember a few, maybe 15 or so years ago, I went to a pub and I had a pint and a half of Guinness, and that was all I had, and that was quite unusual. And I felt so good at that point. Yeah. Maybe it was like 2 pints, but at a pint and a half, I thought, this is the perfect amount of alcohol to drink. I'm buzzing. It feels lovely, but I know I'm not going to wake up funnily in the morning hungover.
Funnily enough, well, my problem is that I never got hungover. I mean, I was just too good at it was my problem. So there was that. But also, it's interesting you say a pint and a half of Guinness, because that's what I've sort of come down to the same conclusion. That is just a pint and a half is just... is just what I like. And I mean, alongside that, I'd say the other realization I've come to is that the only drink that brings about a change in emotional state is the first one, right? Is the first pint. And within a few minutes, often earlier, in probably an anticipation of the feeling you know you're about to get. But anyway, it brings about that change in emotional state. And then I think it is true that every subsequent drink is just a vain, sort of fruitless attempt to recreate that change in emotional state that the first drink gave you. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. And every subsequent drink has, you know, that much less benefit and does that much more harm. Yeah. So if you can really focus on that, you know, I think it's just a good thought to have in your head. You know, when you're teaching somebody to play golf, you say, just don't have too many swing thoughts, just have one thought. Well, if that's one thought for tonight, it is, hang on, beyond that first one, how much difference is it making?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the book is your journey, as well as a few other, you talk to a few other people who are moderating or stopping for different reasons. But you're inviting the reader. And I think even if you didn't invite the reader would do this anyway, to think about their own consumption and why we drink so much. I mean, I found that interesting because I was, you know, I wasn't very sporty and I wasn't very macho, but I think for me, as a kid and as a teenager, drinking was a way of showing you were a man, and drinking a lot was a way of being manly, you know, without, or being grown up, I suppose, without you know, having to fight, hopefully, and without having to be good at sport and stuff. And it's sort of interesting how that, you know, I think that very similarly for you, you find it hard to imagine in your younger years even being friends with someone who doesn't drink, because how would you socialize with them? So it was a way of selecting friends. And then once you've done that, you're sort of trapped within that culture, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, I think you are. And I think there are complex reasons why that's happened. It's due in some part, I would say, to exposure to alcohol and the images we get in television, on television, advertising and so on, when, you know, it is just, you know, from an early age, you know, you see, you know, if I watch football, I'd then see, you know, post-match interviews, oh, you'll enjoy your drink tonight, and he owes you a pint and all that kind of thing. I mean, all these things sort of invade all their way into your young mind. I mean, also, I just think it's a sort of an unintentional consequence of the licensing laws. I remember my dad telling me when I was about 14 or 15, he said, you know, difficult age because you're too old to stay at home all the time, but you're too young to go to the pub. It really sticks in my mind, you know. So, you know, the pub has already become, you know, a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, an answer to the perennial question of life is like, what am I going to do tonight? You know, I'll go to the pub. It's set up to answer to all those questions. But I think you say, you know, all of your friends are, all your friends are, you can't imagine hanging around, as I couldn't, you know, I didn't know. And to this day, I still don't quite know what to do with people who don't drink. You know, it's just because it's just so sort of what I do. You sit down and just have a drink and talk to somebody. That I think what happens then is that you surround yourself with other drinkers. And this happens quite subconsciously, but deliberately. And that is your way of social norming, of just giving yourself permission to drink like every, validating your decisions on that. So, you know, so let's say a clean break, finished school, go to university, you know, left the Midlands, came to London, you know, and over 4 years, let's say I made 30 friends, right? But 30 friends and acquaintances, some close, some not so close, but, you know, people I'm still in touch with, you know, but in extraordinary coincidence, you know, all 30 of them are drinkers.
Yeah.
You know, are big drinkers now. So, you know, already I'm self-selecting that group, which validates and confirms my habits. And I've got somebody to drink with all the time. You think, well, everybody drinks.
Yeah.
Everybody drinks like me. So I'll carry on doing it. But, you know, you have made that, you know, you have made that happen. I have made that happen. And that is a big sin of drinkers like me. It's the kind of arrogance, really, of just saying, well, everybody drinks. Yeah. Everybody drinks this much. I mean, what I keep coming back to is this extraordinary statistic, you know, what it was to me at the time, and to sometimes it still is, that you know, if you take all drinkers, and that, so you take out anyone who's you know, abstemious, you know, you're recovering alcoholic, or you don't drink for religious reasons, or whatever it is, so you never touch a drop. If you take all drinkers, you know, what percentage of all drinkers are drinking within the recommended guidelines for, you know, safe drinking, which, you know, is 14 units, which is about 6.5 pints of beer and so on. And most drinkers, a week, that is, and most drinkers, when you ask them that question, and do feel free to try this, will say, none. Nobody drinks. No drinker drinks that little.
Yeah.
When, in fact, it's like 70% of drinkers drink that little. And even if you allow for a vast margin of error, you know, an error is due to self-reporting of drinking and all that, we all know about underestimating drinking. If you allow for a vast margin of error, you can say that more than half of drinkers, with some certainty, do drink within the guidelines. So we're the outliers. We're the big drinkers. Like, if you want to carry on drinking bigly, as Donald Trump once said, you know, carry on drinking a lot, then, you know, do so by all means. But don't go around saying everybody drinks this much, because it's just not true.
No. Well, you know, I was surprised by that as well. And I thought exactly the same as you. And similarly to you, you feel, I think, when you work in, again, a business where lots of people are drinking, you can always point to 10 or 20 people who drink way more than you. But I think it is very interesting to sort of, I mean, obviously, when you're young and you're having fun, it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world. A, you're enjoying the drinks and your body's young enough to cope with it. It's the fact that you carry on forever. But no, through my 20s, even into my, certainly up to my 40s, and I was comfortably drinking 14 units a night. I mean, you know, and I would very rarely have a night off. Occasionally, I would give up when I was trying to lose some weight or something, and I could stop for a bit. But if I was drinking, I would be out all night drinking. You know, I would assume I drank 50 units in a night sometimes, I would have thought.
Well, like, look, you and, you know, you and me both. I mean, I think the point is that, yes, when you're young, I mean, it does increase your risk of certain, you know, of certain health issues. But when you're young, that comes from a base level of risk, which is very low. So it's less of a problem than when you're sort of in middle age, when you're in your 50s, then your risks are going up all the time. And so adding drink to that risk, it does elevate your risk. But, I mean, what I'd say about that is that, you know, again, getting away from this idea of the alcoholic, i.e. the one who's absolutely addicted and then the rest of us are all okay, right, is that, I mean, I just think it's balls. You know, it's the fact, and I'm indebted to Lee Mack, actually, in the book for expressing it better than I could, is that, you know, it's not somebody's got this disease, alcohol, and somebody hasn't. It's just levels of addiction. You know, if you drink a little bit, you're a bit addicted. You drink all day, every day, you're very addicted. And, you know, and I think, I mean, the trouble is, logically, the more you drink in your, as a youngster, then the more addicted you're likely to get. I mean, that is the chief danger of it. It's just worth giving some thought to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, you write about your university days, and there's lots of funny memories from university, as I have too. I think, like you, you know, we are both maybe not massive hits with girls, and maybe not socially outgoing. Even though I was always performing, I was very shy in public. I felt like drink was a way to, you know, you talk about the having an excuse to drink, but I think also drink is an excuse to behave in the way that you want to behave. Whether, you know, how much of it is really happening, how much drunkenness is you allowing yourself to get drunk or feeling drunk, but it allowed me to be crazy in social situations when I felt like going home most of the time. And it allowed me to talk to girls, though, you know, when I was drunk. So therefore not necessarily the best time to talk to them.
I mean, I'm just remembering some of the chief womanizers among my friendship group at university, and they were drinking like flipping fish as well. So I couldn't really give myself that get out. But right. You talk about our generation. I still ask my daughters. One's left university and one's just started. And I said to them, when they were talking about the challenges of when you first go there and making friends, and it was always went down to the pub, we went to this event, we did this and that. I said, well, what do you do if you don't drink? And they just said, I've got absolutely no idea, how you do it. And it's just, that's just so wrong. We got to think of a different way of sort of doing this.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Do you think that, I've noted, I gave up drinking 3 or 4 years ago for a year, and I found the non-alcoholic drinks a waste of time. But this time, in the last 20 or so months I've not been drinking, I've found the non-alcoholic drinks have improved immeasurably, in fact. Yeah. I know, and in terms of some of the spirits, actually indistinguishable. I keep on having to check the bottle to make sure I haven't accidentally poured out of the actual gin bottle. And I wonder whether that might improve things. It means you can still go to the pub and you can still have a pint in front of you.
That's really helped me having sort of the availability of alcohol-free beer. And I think it's important to remember that alcohol-free beer is probably the second healthiest thing you can drink in a pub after water.
Right.
Because everything else is either alcohol or full of sweeteners.
Yeah.
Or sugar. Right. So, my frustration for a long time is that unlike some, big beery countries like Germany, you'll have a row of pomps and like alcohol free has equal billing.
Right.
With normal beer. And literally the last night was the first time I'd ever seen an alcohol free beer on tap.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was Lucky Saint in a pub near where I live. And, that's a game changer for me because you've got a proper drink to hold.
Yeah.
Because generally for a long time, and it's still generally the case, there'll be a bottle, a poxy little 330ml bottle of Beck's Blue or something, just skulking in the bottom of a fridge behind the bar when it should be sort of out and proud. Heineken do some draft stuff, and I think the Guinness Zero beer is a bit of a game changer as well, as apparently that is on draft in Ireland now.
Right.
I was told, I haven't had it myself, that's a big deal. That does help. Interestingly, go on.
Well, the only thing I think is, you can still, I don't go out as much as anywhere near as I used to, which makes it a lot easier. But the only problem with going, I've been to some parties where, and it's often about sort of 60-40 now, that lots of people aren't drinking, so people feel a bit more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But by the end of the night, if you're sober, you get to see what you're like when you're drunk. Yeah, and it's, but the end of the night is extremely boring. Drunk people are absolute, if you're not drunk as well, you can't really converse with a drunk person, and that's the only downside of it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, actually, Professor David Nutt, who I mentioned in the book, a neuropsychopharmacologist, I think is his branch of medicine, but he's found a way with some company of sort of synthesizing alcohol. Right. So you get the benefits of alcohol without any of the liver, you know, without any of the physical health risks. And he's come up with a, there's a botanical kind of brew called Sencha or something like that, which is, you know, gives you a bit of a buzz.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I think time and again, it's interesting talking about the book, is that you end up sort of distilling down what you really think. I mean, I you know, I wish I could sort of keep rewriting the book, because in conversations like this, you know, sort of, it's sort of different sort of ideas have evolved. And it's, and I realize what you can say that has an impact. And it's so often it's about reframing the way you think about alcohol and think about drinkers. Stuff like realizing you're the outlier. You know, you're not the, you know, the majority are drinking, you know, are drinking within the guidelines. So it becomes a bit like lockdown, where, you know, it's the power of social norm. And if everyone else is abiding by the lockdown rules, then you're happy to abide yourself. If you see other people flouting them, you think, fuck this, I'm gonna go out myself. It's a bit like that with drinking. When you see the world as full of moderate drinkers and you realize you're in the minority, all right, you might just carry on, but you might think, well, you know, I'm a bit different. Yeah. I mean, the other way, sort of counterintuitively, I've thought about how change the way you think, is that there's so much, you know, look at alcohol and you see, you know, it's a good thing, it has its benefits, but generally you might say it's evil, it's had the potential to cause harm, you know, and it is the most harm-causing drug, you know, as more people take it, it causes more harm in A&Es and all the rest of it. But I think the way to look at alcohol might be to say it's actually precious. It's a precious thing. You know, so you think, I've got this precious thing, I'm going to have one drink of that, and it just changes the way I feel. It's relatively cheap. It's relatively safe, drunk at small levels, and it makes you feel like that. So cherish it.
Yeah.
You know, cherish it. I'm not talking about swilling a Chateau, 61 or whatever, and cherishing it like that. Or if that's part of it, that's good, you know, because, you know, less is always more. But just, you know, cherish what that first pint gives you.
Yeah.
You know, I just think, you know, I've used the same kind of language about religion, you know, and I'm, you know, a Catholic convert, and I'm, you know, I'm no sort of evangelical headbanger, but I'm sort of pro-faith. So, you know, somebody like my dad will always, oh, religion causes all wars, you know, a pox on religion. I said, well, it's just what religion does to you. It's how you use religion. If religion makes you a nicer, tolerant, more kind person, then it's a good thing. But, you know, religion can turn you into some, you know, intolerant, you know, murderer, you know, it's not the thing, it's what you do with it. And I think that's true with alcohol, you know.
Yeah.
Do you use it for your benefits, you know, without it controlling you? Do you use it, to socialize in a decent way? Or, you know, or does it come to overwhelm you and turn you into a loon? It's not the thing, it's how you deal with that thing.
And it's understanding yourself, because I think, again, it seems your journey, but also what everyone should be doing is just having a think about why they're drinking. You know, if you're drinking to get to oblivion, then certainly by the time you're in your 40s, you probably want to be examining the reasons for that.
You make an interesting point made by a therapist in the book who'd written a great book called The Kindness Method, which is well worth looking at, called Shuru Izadi. But, you know, I was advancing to her my theories, which she kind of agreed with, this idea of the first drink is all a benefit and every subsequent drink, you know, the benefits diminish and the harms increase. So just stick to the first drink. And it's a focus on that. And she said, yeah, well, that will work. He said, but what if you're drinking for oblivion? Yeah. And then I mean, then I think something different's going on. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, I you know, if your absolute objective is to get smashed out your head, so you don't know which way is up because you want to, you know, escape, because you just want to do it for whatever day, because you want to escape yourself, or you just enjoy being absolutely uncontrollably smashed, then, I mean, less is never going to be more. And, you know, moderation is not going to get you there. So, you know, that's the limitation of my way forward. And actually, another woman said something really interesting in the book, a sort of a client of Sheroux's, actually, a writer called Marissa Bate. And she made an interesting point. You know, he said the trouble is that sort of moderating drinking, being careful about drinking, runs counter to a lot of what therapy tells you about living in the moment. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. Live in this moment. Well, it's not a big stretch to think, I'm living in the moment. I fucking am. Right, down goes the bottle of scotch. I'm living in this moment. I don't care about tomorrow. I don't care about yesterday. Well, you know, that runs counter, and that is another challenge. I hadn't really thought of that, I must say.
Yeah. I mean, not everyone. For me, I find moderation in anything very difficult. I can either give something up, which I'm quite good at, but with chocolate's worse than alcohol for me. If I eat chocolate, it happened last night. I just had a biscuit and thought that'll be fine, and then 5 minutes later, I've eaten half a drawer of chocolate.
You know what? I'm exactly the same with I'm like that with food,
right?
And when people talk about drink in that context, they say I haven't got an off switch, right?
Yeah,
I can't stop when I start. Now, you know, mercifully with drink, though I've drunk an enormous amount of my time, you know, when it gets, say, 11 o'clock and I'm not, I do tend to go home, but there's others who will just go on into the night, just cannot stop at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not like that with drink. I am like that with food. When I, you know, if I'm not careful once I start, I just can't, you know, I just can't stop. So I need a different approach to that, which actually, interestingly, is just don't start. I mean, obviously, I've got to eat something, but I know if I have one cream cracker, I will have the whole box.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. That's a particular trigger for me, or generally, I can just get into an absolute feeding frenzy. I mean, I mentioned in the book a guy called Paul Cook, who was a drummer in the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And I mean, the reason I mentioned him in the book because he said something interesting about heroin, about being addicted to heroin and getting off it. And he said, you know, it was wasted on young idiots like me. You know, it was, you know, that's the tragedy of it. You know, when I'm 80, he said, you know, that's when I'll need it. When I'm in pain, I can't get about. And obviously I'll be on the gear the whole time. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting, I mean, I think he was joking, but it's an interesting thought that, because it's a bit like I always want to have access to drink. I want to be able to sit in a pub and have a quiet pint, you know, when I'm in my 70s and 80s, if I'm still going then. By that stage, I don't want to be so addicted. I can't just have one pint, and I don't want my liver to be fucked. And I just want, you know, so it's for the love of drinking. I want to drink less.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have a drink with Paul, with Cookie, every now and then. And we were talking about another friend of ours who shall remain nameless, for whom a quiet couple of early evening pints are no use whatsoever. They're actual torture. And he will actually just not take part in that.
Right.
If he knows he can't crack on until 3 a.m, he won't, you know, he just won't take part. And Cookie was saying, he said, I feel a bit sorry for him. He can't do this. Just meet for a quick pint, have a quick chat.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be more than, it's got to, you know, it's got to go the whole way. And I feel sorry for people who are in that, you know, who get in that state.
Yeah,
you know,
it is interesting.
AMI.
It is interesting. And it is of, you know, like you say, it's all these individual experiences. I don't, you know, like I say, I've stopped, but not really consciously. It's interesting to read this book because I've, you know, been thinking, oh, you know, I'd like a glass of whiskey at the end of the night, but then, yeah, even when I wasn't drinking loads when I stopped, but I just even like a, you know, a home measure of whiskey would still make me wake up in the middle of the night feeling a bit weird sometimes and a bit panicky. Yeah. It's all the stuff that comes with it. It's nice drinking at the time, but as you get older, the effects are worse. And you know, as you say, you know, this is a drug that makes you anxious.
I would be heartbroken if you know, I'll see you in a year's time, and you, you know, and you're drinking 8 pints of strong European lager a night, and you, then you blame it all on me. So, I certainly wouldn't do that. But no. It does intrigue me how you had that pint and a half of Guinness revelation.
Yeah.
But then, you know, didn't learn from that in the sense of thought, well, generally, not every time, I'll stick with this, I'll ring fence this.
I think it's just because I think it becomes associated with something in your life. And I think for me, it was a way of overcoming my shyness and a way of doing stuff that I wanted to do. I think, like, in terms of, you know, I probably, once I got a bit older, I would go out on dates and I'd always drink and probably get drunk. But it was, you know, I don't think through my 20s, I'm not sure I ever had sex without being at least a little bit drunk throughout my 20s.
What I was getting at,
I think it was a big part of it.
Okay, why did you continue drinking a lot after you'd identified the pint and a half of Guinness sweet spot? That's the bit I don't understand.
I think because it's still, you're still using it. I think that's what's interesting about this book. You're still using it for that crutch, for that. This makes me interesting. This means I'm part of the party. This means, you know, if I go on a, this was before I met my wife, I was still dating. If you go out on a date and someone's not drinking, you know, again, you judge them or they might judge you. Yeah. And also it's just that lubricant, social lubricant, to get into a place where you can be, you know, I think it might just be you can behave in a way you want to behave. Maybe there's more consciousness behind it and you can be a bit more outspoken. But if I wasn't drunk or if I didn't have that excuse of being drunk, I think, I'd have found it much more difficult. Yeah. I found socializing quite difficult anyway, but I would have found it much more difficult. So I think that it's the association with the past. And I think that's why men in their 40s and 50s are still drinking 6 or 7 pints. It's because that's what you did when you were 20, isn't it? It's
but
crazy
still,
to do it.
But you're still hanging, I'm still hanging around with those people, you know, who I was at school with, I was at college with. And I mean, there was an interesting one, which I mentioned in the book, a guy I used to drink with, actually a judge now. And I met him one evening, we managed to meet somewhere. And I said, what you're having? And I went up to the bar. He said, oh, I'm driving. I'll just have a half. And I felt insulted. It was like, I felt like saying, is this all I mean to you now? You know, you don't even treat me. It was absurd.
Yeah.
It was absolutely stinking thinking. And just, as the producer of that documentary, Jess, as the documentary I made about it, as she said, alcohol's the only drug you have to apologize for not taking.
Yes.
You know, I think that's so true. So I sort of made a solemn promise, which I've almost kept to, is that, you know, never again would I pressure anybody into drinking. And never again would I be pressured into drinking by anyone.
Yeah.
And I'm more or less stuck to that. You know, now, however, I gave all this spiel, what I just said to you, to an audience at the Birmingham Literary Festival, just next to the town hall where I did your podcast with you. And I gave all the speech and everyone's nodded. And I saw at the back the mate I'd arranged to meet afterwards, you know, my one of the best mate in Birmingham, Simo, known as. And I hadn't seen him for ages, really looking forward to seeing him after this thing finished at 10 o'clock. And even as I was talking, I thought, fuck, you know, it's still true that if, you know, we go to the pub after this and he says, oh, I'm not drinking, you know, I'd be upset even now. I just can't help myself, you know. It's absurd, you know. And I'm working on this.
It's interesting how ingrained it is into us. And I think, you know, it's learnt behavior and then it's very hard to shift. And I mean, I used to go out with all my university friends at Christmas, and you know, if there was ever a Christmas I wasn't drinking, which there occasionally was, you know, that it was like a problem, you know. I think so. I think I probably did drink because I didn't want to be who's letting my friends down. But if they're your friends, they shouldn't care. But maybe it's more for men than women. I'm not sure that's true, but from my point of view, I think it is. As someone who's always kind of rejected machoism and anything with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think like through beer and eating curries, maybe was my way of demonstrating that, you know, I was one of the lads and that I was, you know, drink, you know, we used to try and drink 8 pints before 8 o'clock in the college bar or whatever. And I could do that. And well, I couldn't do it now. I mean, I can't, just well, the
congratulations. The, yeah. But I still don't know what you do. I still don't know quite what you do with people who don't drink.
Yeah.
I mean, say I was, I don't know, say I met someone at work. So I live in like near you. Would you want to meet up tonight? You don't drink. I say we're not. Okay, you can go for a meal. But where else could you go, even if you don't drink that much, but sit in a pub with somebody for 3-4 hours?
Yeah.
Drinking at whatever pace and chatting. How do you do that otherwise?
Yeah,
I mean, difficult. I could go for a walk. In fact, somebody in an Australian was saying to me that is more of a thing in Australia. He just said you meet people. He was a big British boozer, yeah, but he lived in Australia in Sydney. He said, oh, people say, oh, let's go out for a walk. You know, that kind of social drinking and chatting was less part of it there. So people would say, you know, like proper big Aussies, oh, let's go for a walk together. Right. You know, and I quite like that, you know, I'll do that. But it's still not like sitting down and just drinking and chatting.
No.
What do people who don't drink do? I mean, you can't drink coffee all night. You never get to sleep.
It's true. It's difficult to think of. I mean, you could go 10-pin bowling. You could do something like that. You could.
No, but, you know, you
the cinema, that's no good. Yeah.
You want to talk to somebody. Then I don't know. And I was just thinking, I spent a lot of time in a little village in South Wales, and it just struck me, you know, during, you know, just after lockdown, it still wasn't sort of the pubs, just one pub there. It wasn't open. I just thought, you know, without the pub, you know, there's nowhere for the community to go in the evening.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of them, you know, I don't want to think everybody wants to go to the pub. A lot of people, they never go to the pub. There's not pub people. But, I mean, it is literally the only thing that's open that's within walking distance.
Yeah.
There is nowhere else to go. So I think pubs are important in that regard. I mean, you know, you don't have to drink, but as community hubs, I think they're more or less on their own, you know, particularly in rural places.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a British thing. I don't know if, you know, I think it's so ingrained in sort of UK and Irish culture, to be fair, so that you know, I don't know if it's the same elsewhere. Maybe it's to do with even, you know, like in France, they don't worry about, you know, kids will have wine earlier on and they're not making a big deal of it. I wonder if just the very kind of that illicit nature of it when, yeah, you are 12 or 13 or 14 and the fact you get this drink, yeah, and you've done something amazing, and maybe you never quite lose. I think you talk about that. You never quite lose that feeling of, oh, I've been served, I've got the drink.
I'm still slightly pleasantly surprised. I'm 55. You know, I think we've got to be careful. It just occurs to me, talking to you now, we often say, oh, well, that's the Northern European drinking model, going out and getting smashed. Now, how many times have you heard people saying that?
Yeah.
You know, it's not the Southern Europe sitting down for a couple of days. It's the British go out and get smashed. Well, you know, that's true. We have that. But it's just to reiterate, it's only a minority of,
yeah,
us,
okay,
who are like that. You know, it's not, you know, it's not generally the case. But then I was also thinking today, I mean, it was the first day of filming. It was before a West Brom game, before I made the documentary. And I was in the pub, and it was a pub, we're playing Liverpool, and there were a lot of Scousers in there, and they were pissed out their heads at the back. And I mean, it was midday kickoff. They've been in there since about 8 in the morning. And so, you know, once again, I was doing that thing. And I'd had 4 pints, right, of Guinness. But even then I was thinking, oh, they're drinking more than me. You know, yeah, I'm, you know, at some level I was thinking I've got it in more in control than they have.
Yes.
And, but then talking to a couple of these lads, I said, oh, so, you know, I've got talking about drinking. And he said, oh, that's the only time I drink. I only drink when Liverpool play. So that's once a week.
Right.
And I think one of them said he only drinks for a Liverpool away games.
Right.
At home, he doesn't bother. It's just what he does. They go out and get smashed Liverpool away games. So I'm busy sort of not looking down on them exactly, but thinking, oh, you know, drinking far too much. Shame on you. I mean, I probably drink much more than them over, yeah, a week. In fact, I'm sure I do.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, how much more you get. You do get a lot more done, and you do feel, you know, I've got young kids, so I don't feel like, yeah, not tired. I still feel tired because I'm still up at 5:30 or 6:30 every day. But I think, you know, if I was up at 5:30, 6:30, and that might be part of why I've stopped, really. It's just if I was up with even a minor, yeah, hangover, yeah, at that time, it would just make the morning sort of unbearable.
But even then, you know, when I was at that, in that phase of my life with young kids, it was, you know, as Roy Keane says in the book, there's always an excuse to drink. So yeah, getting the kids off to sleep, the little bleeders, I finally got them down, read the story at last, you know, open the up the wine, the beer, whatever, off you go.
Yeah.
Taken for a walk in the evening, the baby girl, I'd sit in the pub with Paul Cook's dad, usually, interestingly. Old Tommy used to drink in there. You know, that it, you know, couldn't go out, so you just drink at home. You know, if you're wired for it, you'll always find a way of, you know, yeah, you find a way of drinking.
Yeah. Well, look, it's a very interesting book, and it really made me think a lot about all sorts of things, really, and about myself. So that's good. I would recommend it to drinkers and non-drinkers. It's definitely worth thinking about this. I noticed you drank in Albertines, unsurprisingly, in Shepherd's Bush, which I just drove past the other day, and I was disappointed to see it closed down. I used to live in Shepherd's Bush, so I used to go there quite a lot, but it's closed down now, which is that feels like when a wine bar or a pub dies and is gone, that it still feels like it feels like a death in the family, really.
A bit of viewers gone.
So it's a shame to see that go, but. The book is called The Good Drinker, and it's available. Have you done the audio book?
I have done an audio book. Yeah, I just think, what a hostage to bloody fortune The Good Drinker is. I'm going to have to give up sort of bar brawling, streaking, and all other kind of drunken hijinks. I'll have to stop them now, because if I get caught,
it'll be
terrible.
Although, you know,
I thought at one stage I suggested we put The Good Drinker ? Just to give myself, give myself a way out.
Well, because with these things, you know, that's why I don't make a big deal about having stopped drinking, and I'm not saying I've given up drinking, because you know, you never know where you'll find yourself, and I know myself too well to know that, you know, I lose weight and then I put the weight back on and I'd stop drinking and I start drinking again. I do feel for myself that I might have actually hit the point where I'm not going to go back in any serious way. Yeah. But you can't predict where the future's going to go. And I sort of admire it. I admire you for finding that way through, and for, as you say, for just, if it's 50 units to 35 units, that's still a very very important.
Yeah, well, those 15 units between 50 and 35 that you're losing, that's doing relative. You're doing you relatively more good than going from 30 to 15 units, even though that involves halving your intake. You know, it's just because the way the risk increases very steeply the more you drink, so it decreases very steeply. The less you drink from that high level.
But don't
get back into it.
Occasionally miss it, but I don't think I miss it enough, weirdly. I love drinking when I drank. Most of the time it was fun. Sometimes it led me to do ridiculous and stupid things. Most of those were funny things, you don't want to live in a world where people are feeling they can't do anything that's naughty or bad for them without. But I think for certain people, it's definitely worth looking at. And I think it's exactly that. It's the group of people that you and I have been in who really sort of think, yeah, I'm fine. You know, I remember a girlfriend who didn't drink. I had like 20 or 25 years ago who was convinced I was an alcoholic, and I was convinced I wasn't, because she didn't drink at all. So the amount that I drank to her seemed unbelievable. Yeah. Whereas, you know, I just told her she was ridiculous. I think she was being a bit ridiculous, but equally she could see something that I couldn't see about myself, that I was relying on drink too much. So it's,
but
you know,
you could see you were just drinking a lot, you know, it's again that alcoholic label.
Yeah.
You know, you're either drinking a medium amount, or an awful lot. And next to somebody who doesn't drink at all, then, one pint a night looks like an astonishing thing to do. But, you know, like where you've got to, you know, you do, you know, so don't do it, mate.
I won't. Well, the book's great. I love your writing style's great, Adrian. It's very authentic, and that's what I like about it. It's not, you're not a pretentious writer, but you also do come up with some, you know, you recognize a lovely phrase for yourself and in other people's writing as well in this book. And so it's a lover of words, and it's an easy book to read, and a book that will make you think a lot. So thank you very much for talking to me about it. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing this show. Hope to see you again soon, Adrian. I can have a non-alcoholic beer with you at some point.
Cheers, mate. I'll have one for you as well.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.